Yeah, I mean, I think regardless of what business you're in, whether you're a business coach, whether you're a speaker and trainer, whether you're, you know, a restaurant or a hotel, whether you're a design agency or a tech company, you're really about figuring out how do we deliver this product and create an experience that people tell stories about. Hmm. How do we get people talking about this? And ultimately, the stories come from the experience. And I think you're right. I think that is the same goal regardless of what you do.
So you're a smart business committed to innovation, to service, and to modern marketing. And you're asking, what's next? Wondering how you can become even more innovative. My name is Jürgen Strauss from InnovaBiz, and this is the InnovaBuzz podcast, where we share all kinds of tips, advice, and interview guests on all things innovation and leadership in modern marketing. Hi, innovators. It's great to be back. I hope you've had an awesome week so far. I'm really excited to have on the InnovaBuzz podcast today as my guest, Mike Ganino, who's the author of Company Culture for Dummies, a new book which is due for release in May. Mike is a keynote speaker, a coach, and an employee engagement consultant. He helps companies create cultures that engage teams, that thrill customers, and drive bottom lines. I love that triple bottom line analogy. There's a lot of really valuable content in today's episode where Mike and I talk about customer experience, we talk about employee satisfaction and retention, and we talk about the impact of leaders on the company culture and the company culture's impact on bottom line results. Without further ado then, let's fly into the hive and get the buzz from Mike Ganino. Hi, I'm your host Jürgen Strauss from InnovaBiz, and I'm really excited to welcome to the InnovaBuzz podcast today, all the way from Los Angeles, Mike Ganino, the author of Company Culture for Dummies, which is a new book that's due for release in May. He's also a keynote speaker, a culture and employee engagement consultant, and he helps companies create cultures that engage teams, that thrill customers, and drive bottom lines. And I love that triple sort of hammer there. So welcome to the podcast, Mike. It's a great privilege to have you as a guest.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm excited. We're doing the pond hopping episode from Australia to LA.
Yeah, that's right. So Neen James, who was on episode 111, introduced me to Mike and suggested that we interview you on the podcast. So a big hello to Neen as well.
A fellow Australian, actually, a fellow Aussie.
That's right, yeah. But living, and it was funny because when I chatted to Neen and I hadn't met her before, we discovered that she lives very close to where I used to live back in the 1980s in a little place called Bluebell in Pennsylvania.
So oh, that's funny.
Yeah, it is. Anyway, so before we talk about culture and creating experience that drive bottom line results and improve customer service and attracting top talent, they're all things that I'm really interested in, so I'm really excited to hear some more about that. But let's find out some more about you as a person first. So when you're a young child, did you envisage going into this sort of area?
I don't think so. I don't think I had an idea that this was an area. And actually, probably in the 1980s, if you think about like what company culture was like in the 1980s, I don't think people were talking about it back then. So, no, when I was little, I guess I kind of knew I wanted to do something like this. I knew that I wanted to be a performer. I thought I wanted to be an actor or a singer. I just love being on stage. I love connecting with people, helping people figure things out. And so when I was little, I probably wanted to do it more in that way. And then I learned there were other ways to do it. And here I am with a book and out there talking about how to work better together.
Yeah. Now, you've spent over 20 years in hospitality and travel industry, haven't you? So was that kind of where you formed the nucleus of your philosophies around customer service and how to connect with people and in particular with customers?
Yeah, you know, I had a really interesting background that I never really knew how it went together for a long time. I was in the hospitality and travel industry, like you said, working for airlines, restaurants, hotels. And I realized that was really all about creating an experience, an experience for your employees and an experience for your guests and your passengers. And at the same time, I was studying improv acting, improvisational theater, at a place called Second City in Chicago. And I never really thought those two things went together. And in the last, you know, 5 or 6 years, I've realized there's actually this really interesting intersection, because in improvisational theater, we're trying to create an experience for the audience. We're trying to use whatever we've got available to us, whatever information, whatever we can create as actors on stage, to create a show on the fly, literally from nothing, for the audience. And I realized that's a lot of times what we're trying to do in the hospitality industry. We're trying to create experiences for people. And if somebody comes in with a bad day or something's broken and we have to fix it, sometimes we have to improvise and we have to think on the fly about how do I still achieve my objective? And so in the last couple of years, I've actually realized that those two worlds kind of blended together. And it's been kind of fun to play with that idea a little bit.
Hmm. Yeah, that's fascinating. And I liked reading some of the blog posts and articles you posted on LinkedIn around hospitality and travel, and where you talk a lot about creating that experience. And I reflected on that and thought, well, really, that's a metaphor for essentially all business, because a business, you know, fundamentally is about delivering an experience to their customer, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I think regardless of what business you're in, whether you're a business coach, whether you're a speaker and trainer, whether you're, you know, a restaurant or a hotel, whether you're a design agency or a tech company, you're really about figuring out how do we deliver this product and create an experience that people tell stories about. Mm. How do we get people talking about this? And ultimately, the stories come from the experience. And I think you're right. I think that is the same goal regardless of what you do. Even, you know, I was recently in a new book by a guy named Dr. Bob Baker called The Performance of Medicine. He interviewed me for a chapter on using improvisation in the patient-doctor relationship, how the doctor can use performance techniques from improvisational theater to create a better experience with the patient. So I think you're right that it goes into all business, even into like healthcare.
Mm. Oh, absolutely. Now, of course, when you talk about improvisation, a lot of the background or underlying principles there are around communication. And I know you talk a lot around communication, and that's one area where I think healthcare has a long way to go, and there's huge opportunities there. I mean, if you imagine, you know, going to the doctor and you've got some ailment and the doctor says, well, you know, I'm really sorry, that's bad news. That's a totally different message and puts the patient in a totally different mindset than if the doctor were to say, well, here's what I know, here's the facts as I see them, here's what you need to do to maximize your chances of getting rid of whatever that ailment is.
Yeah, and even down to in the medical field of just even a lot of the jargon, you know, these doctors go to school for so long that they know all this information and they know terminology and things that the average patient doesn't really understand. And there's this communication barrier often if the doctor isn't really good at creating a different kind of experience about focusing on the story that the patient is creating in their mind while they're visiting. So yeah, there's a huge opportunity. And I'd imagine that there's a huge gap in patient compliance where the patient actually is doing what the doctor's recommended. They're following through on the course of action and doing the medicine and doing the work, largely because of communication. I think there's a lot of places where that communication gap is actually causing life and death type issues.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. And you're right, because the patient does have a pretty vital role in improving their situation, don't they? And a lot of it comes back to what they end up telling themselves unconsciously and what, you know, what beliefs they build.
Yeah. All those little stories that we tell ourselves, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Now, I'm fascinated because you talk a lot about culture and certainly your new book is about company culture. I'm fascinated because you mentioned earlier about that was something that wasn't around much in the 80s. Now, I remember back in the 80s when I was in my corporate career, and there was a lot of work done in our company, and I'm sure other companies did the same thing around mission, vision, values, and talked about culture. And a lot of the times I was kind of like, oh, what is this thing, really. And then there were workshops done, and there was a lot of great talking, and you came away from that feeling really fantastic and having had a great experience. But then all that it became was some platitudes and placards on a wall or something like that that didn't really translate into the day-to-day behavior of the company. So what's your view of, I mean, first of all, what do you define as the culture of a business?
Yeah, so the culture of the business for me is the kind of daily operational reality. What are the norms? What are the conditions that allow things to happen? And so culture for me is not about necessarily what's hanging on the wall, like you said, what is the placard in the break room, or what's written in the employee handbook, or what are the nice words on the website. It's really about watching, and it comes down, you know, earlier you said that I talk a lot about communication, and you're right, it is so much about communication. It's about how we communicate what matters to each other, how we communicate what's okay and what's not okay, how we communicate the expectations with each other. And so culture ultimately comes down to the organizational story that we live out every day. If you watch a company, and a lot of times when I'm doing consulting or I'll come in for some advisory work, I just have to watch a couple of meetings. I have to watch the way people communicate. How do they share ideas? Who holds back? Who's not sharing great ideas? And where did that come from? And you very quickly, by watching the way people communicate, can get the culture. You know, a lot of times when I go in, people will say, oh, let us show you our culture. And they want to show me the nap rooms and the slides and the ping pong tables and the food trucks that they've got outside. And I always say, like, no, those are lovely things, but that's not your culture. I want to go on a meeting. I want to go see how people make decisions. I want to see what happens when someone needs help. Do people go out of their way to help them, or do they kind of watch them fail? I want to see when an employee is struggling, does a manager go over and say, hey, let me help you with that. You look like you need a little bit of help. That's culture to me. Those little stories that are inside, that's the culture.
Mm. So it's the day-to-day behavior. I think somewhere you said culture is the operating system of your brand. And you followed that up with a question, have you defined it yet? So given what you've told us about the culture and it's the day-to-day operation, and a lot of those things are a little bit intangible. They're kind of behaviors and indicators. What, how do you go about defining that and then coming to a point of saying, well, you know, there are gaps here or there's something that's not quite right here, going about a change process then in culture, a real change process, so not just writing something down that's different.
Yeah, it takes a lot of work on the front end around getting clear. And so I kind of go through this three-step process where the first one is really getting clear on what's actually going on. What is the reality today? What is the, I always call it the cultural reality. So that comes from going and listening to stories, from talking to employees, from seeing what are the common themes that we're seeing here. And there's a lot of interviewing that goes on. There's a lot of watching decision-making happening. Some of it's looking at the artifacts, so the handbook and the orientation program and the placards on the wall and the way that they do performance review and the way they do compensation. Those are all artifacts to me. And so I'll look at those because those systems can sometimes have an effect on culture. They are not culture in their own, but they can impact culture. And so we'll look at all the artifacts. We'll collect all of that. We'll do a bunch of story listening of, you know, there's a lot of interesting things that happen when you get employees in a room and you say, hey, how do we make decisions around here? Like when something difficult's happened, how do you talk through it? And sometimes you hear, talk through it. What are you talking about? We don't talk through it. Mm. And sometimes you hear like a much different process and you start to be able to organize like, oh, this is a group of people that deals with adversity this way. This is a group of people that deals with challenges this way. And you start to create this kind of organizational theme, or like you said earlier, the operating system. What is the operating system of this group? What's in, what's out? How do they do things? And once we have all that together, then we can go and say, okay, what are the results that you're getting or not getting? And one of the challenges I see a lot of times when people try to do cultural change is they don't think about what is the result that's happening because of this culture, because there's some output the other side. Are we not getting new products launched? Are we not giving the kind of service that we want to give? Are we not effectively keeping our best people? So I always start after that little story review session and artifact review, I always go back to, okay, so why did you make the call to me in the first place? What were you looking up on the internet when you found me that you thought, oh, I think culture might be our problem? Because, you know, very few people go and say, our culture is the issue, we must need to fix it, out of the blue. Yeah. They might recognize a recruiting issue. They might recognize a sales issue. They might recognize a service issue. They might recognize a workplace civility issue or a leadership issue. But they usually don't come to me and say, I was just thinking about culture and decided to call you. That never happens. And so I find that by getting clear on the business result that is an issue, we can then say, okay, let's work through solving some of these culture problems that we uncovered in your story by thinking through how we're going to solve these business issues. And it's a little bit of a different process because a lot of the culture consultants come in and they do exactly what you said. It's like, hey, let's define your mission and vision and values and put them on a wall and have a culture change meeting. And it's like, that's not how groups of people change. That's not how shifts are made.
Yeah. Yeah. And I really like, you know, your approach about the customer experience, the employee experience, and, you know, which impacts on employee retention and employee satisfaction and their essentially their performance then, and also the bottom line results, because they're the indicators, and people, you know, people often say, well, culture and mission, vision, values and all this sort of stuff is soft stuff. We're not really that, you know, it's sort of wishy-washy, and, you know, it can be wishy-washy, but when you link it up to the performance of the business in those three areas, then it becomes something really concrete. And then tackling it from that as the indicator of perhaps a problem really brings it back to the fundamentals, doesn't it?
That's right. And you're exactly right in saying there's this idea that these things are wishy-washy. And I actually agree that most of the time they are because they're often just things put on the wall. So of course they're wishy-washy because they're just the nice stuff we tell each other when we want to say nice things to each other. We talk about our values and our mission, but we don't actually use it every day to run the business. We don't actually use it to say, hey, is how this person behaving, is that in line with who we are? Are we going to go say something? I just saw a senior leader do something that's not in line with our espoused values. It becomes wishy-washy when you decide to do nothing. Then it's wishy-washy. Then it is the soft stuff because, oh, it's so soft it doesn't even stand up to the first time someone challenged it.
Yeah, yeah.
It becomes the hard stuff when you say, you know what, I got to go have this conversation.
Yeah, which brings up a great question, and that's what's the role of the leader in that organizer or in any organization in terms of building a great culture and building a culture of service. And that's always something that I can look at things. I'm not an expert in this area, but I can look at organizations and think, well, you know, there's something broken from the top down there. And because it's like you say, there's things that happen that aren't in alignment with what they say is their culture or their mission, vision, values.
Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting because I have this philosophy that it is the job of the leader to fuel the culture, but they can't control it. And all of these, you know, employee engagement is like a big buzzword right now. It's everywhere. And we're spending billions of dollars in employee engagement activities. And yet, you know, if you look at a lot of the research, it's showing that the employee engagement is flatlined, that it's not gotten better, and we just keep spending more money. And I think it's because we're approaching employee engagement as if, like, the employees need us to come in and, like, you know, shake them up and keep them entertained like they're children at work. And the issue is that that's not really where engagement comes from. We keep thinking that the issue of engagement is that the employees have an engagement issue. No, the reality is that as a leader and as a company, we're not being engaging enough. It is our job to engage them. It's not their job to have engagement. And we keep approaching it by saying, you know, they need naps and they need massages and they need lunches and they need, you know, fun walls. But working at a resort doesn't mean you're any more engaged. And engagement comes from relationships and from communication. And so the job of the leader is not to control the culture or try to control the engagement. It's impossible to do. The same way as controlling someone else's story is nearly impossible. But you can fuel it. You can add the kindling to the fire that allows them to tell that story. And so the job of the leader is to say, what am I putting into this? What is the conversations? What are the touch points and the milestones I'm putting into the culture so it can fuel the story of the employees? And the issue is that often what we're putting in is you know, fancy coffee bars and happy hours, and that's not really fueling the right story for the brand. The issue with employees is not, oh, if I could only have a chair massage, I would care more about customers. That's not the challenge. And yet that's what we keep trying to do to fix it.
Yeah. And it kind of prompted a thought in my mind there. You talked about, you know, they're not children, but the analogy with children is it's you know, buying lollies for the children or buying the expensive toys for the children as a substitute for spending quality time with them and building the relationship, isn't it?
That is perfectly, exactly, 100% right. It isn't the substitute. Painting fancy walls and getting cool ergonomic chairs is not the, those things can happen. Those can be positive, but it ain't going to fix everything for you. You've got to start with the relationship. Like you just said, I love that analogy.
So you also said something there about employee engagement and a common complaint about employees aren't engaged enough and so on. Now we hear a lot about today about millennials and that millennials are different in terms of, you know, their attention span is so short and their loyalty is not real strong because there's so many distractions that they have, and so it's really hard to keep them motivated and keep them engaged. And I always think that, you know, this is a bit of a myth. And I think you said on a podcast that I listened to that, you know, if you go back into thousands of years of history, that the older generations have always complained about the younger generations, and it's probably the same thing now. And I've always thought that was the case as well. But would you like to comment a little bit more on that?
Oh my gosh, this is my favorite topic to rant on because it's just so inaccurate. I think the biggest crime that millennials have committed is that they were the first generation to grow up with the internet and with clickbait media. So there's just a lot of articles that nobody actually reads with bad science and bad research and bad studies that are easy to see the headlines on LinkedIn and Facebook, and nobody's actually looking at the research. It's like, oh yeah, one time I met a millennial and they were on their phone, so this must be true of everybody. I think when you generalize, you know, whatever the number is, 100 million people or something in this group, you make big mistakes of generalizing that. And so, you know, I always think about my grandma, you know, so my grandma is not a millennial, obviously. And I think about when she was at work, there were just different options. The internet changed our options dramatically. And so if my grandma was going to work every day, and my family is from a small, like, rural town, and where she grew up, I grew up in California, but she grew up in a small town in the Midwest of the United States, and, you know, kind of country area, and she didn't have many options. So if she went to work and the job was not good and the boss wasn't nice and she didn't really know what she was working for, she just came in and punched a clock and did the daily production and then left, she didn't have a lot of options for another job. Like, she couldn't go on the internet and find another place to work. If she wanted to apply for a job, she had to physically show up at the building with a you know, paper to fill out. And the ability to figure out who was hiring and where to go. I mean, if the newspaper only came out once a week, that was the only time you could find a job. And so there weren't the options. So if she was unhappy and felt unmotivated and didn't feel like she had a purpose at work and didn't have, you know, and you're, like you were saying, didn't have a relationship with her manager or the owner of the company, she didn't have choices. She couldn't go and create a t-shirt shop on the internet and start feeding it with Instagram and YouTube videos. That wasn't a choice. I think the difference today is that this generation has said to employers and to businesses, I don't have to work for you. Yeah. If you're gonna mistreat me, if you're not gonna help me understand, like, what are we doing and why are we doing it and why does it matter? And you say we're gonna grow, but what are we gonna grow into? And what is the work I'm doing? How is that helping us? What's the story of all my work, all my time that I'm away from my family and the things I love to do? What story am I creating here? If you're not going to tell me that as a business, then I have other choices. And that, I think, is the actual truth of millennials, is that it's the first generation that has been able to say, I don't have to work for you.
Yeah, that's right. I think a lot of businesses don't understand that people today have a lot more choices, and perhaps they're still living in the past where they think, you know, the employees are dependent on them for a living or whatever, and they don't have to build that relationship. But I was reading something recently, and it was about the baby boomers generation, my generation, so I'm dating myself here, and it was written in the 60s, and it basically talked about baby boomers being lazy and lacking attention and being disloyal and so on. But then it went on to say that that's all a myth, and that what they're actually looking for is they're searching for meaning in what they do. They're searching for meaning in their life. They're searching for meaning in their work. They're searching for, you know, how they can contribute and what difference they can make in the world. And I thought, well, really, isn't that what everybody's looking for?
Yeah, it's funny because if you do, it's like what you were saying. If you go back and think about every generation has had that. Every generation, the problem is old people and young people. That's the problem, I think. I don't think it's actual generation. I just think it's the old people don't understand the young people. The young people don't understand the old people. And so they make up these stories about it. And there's actually a really old quote that's attributed to Socrates. There's some debate of whether he said it or not. And the quote says something along the lines of, like, you know, children now love luxury. They have bad manners. They have contempt for authority. They show disrespect for elders. They love chatter in place of exercise. They're tyrants. They're not servants of their households. They don't rise when older people enter the room. They contradict their parents. And you could substitute that for literally any generation and it would work. And it is attributed to Socrates. So it's just what we do when we don't understand other people.
So it's a communication between the generations, isn't it?
Yeah. There's some interesting barrier there.
Yeah. Thought's gone out of my mind now. I was thinking about, it's gone. All right, what's next? So you also talk about default thinking and limiting beliefs in terms of, being barriers to making change. So talk to us a little bit about that.
Yeah, this actually borrows a little bit from my improvisational theater side. In Company Culture for Dummies, one of the things is, in the beginning of the book, it talks about what is culture, and then it talks about my obsession with you need to benchmark and measure any of the changes that you're going to make, so you should figure out where you're at today so you can see if the culture work you're doing is benefiting you so it doesn't just become another fad. And then I immediately go into a chapter called Managing Ourselves. And I remember with the editor, they said, why is this chapter's a little bit, you know, kind of spiritual, if you will, because I talked about managing your own energy, becoming aware of how your presence in a conversation changes it. And is it doing it the way you want? And there's this whole piece about our beliefs and how what we believe has the power to impact the way we lead and the way we show up for our teams. And so they were like, I don't know if this belongs in this book about culture. And I was like, yeah, it does, because the way that people show up, the beliefs that managers and leaders have impact the way they make decisions. And so often in our work, we operate on default. It's, you know, this looks like the last time it happened. So it must, you know, the same thing is going to happen here. We have these little biases that come in and say, well, if this kind of looks like this other situation, it's easier for me to just assume the same thing's going to happen. So I'm going to go on default thinking. And it's not bad. It's actually very natural for us as humans to have default thinking. There's something like, you know, 11 million stimuli that we have every moment, and there's no way we can process it all. So we need our brain to be able to say, okay, I'm going to take care of 99.999% of these, and we're just going to go on default with them. And then, you know, you deal with this other little bit. And the challenge is that we often do that in our conversations with people. We do that when we think of millennials often. This is the problem is, oh, this is like every other millennial I've ever met. Simply because I was born in the same 27-year time span, I'm like everyone else. And that default thinking can make you ignore information. It makes you ignore new information because you say, oh, this is like everything else, so I don't need to think about it. It makes you make really bad decisions because you think you just keep doing what you've always done instead of saying, I wonder if I should question this. I mean, a very strong case there is people who say, well, I'm having this issue with youth today. I can't get any good people to apply. I'm not getting any top talent. And then when I recommend and say, well, let's look at the way you're talking to them in the job postings. What does your job posting look like? And it's boring and it's average. And it's like, well, of course great people aren't applying to this. This sounds like the worst job ever because it's just a listing of requirements. Like, you know, they don't approach the job posting as if it's a sales piece, which it is a sales piece. You're trying to market to someone that this is a place to come and work. And so they push back to me sometimes of like, well, you know, people today. And it's like, well, you're not changing. You're saying I'm not getting results, and you're also unwilling to change the way that you lead, the way you hire, the way you attract, the way you recruit. That's an interesting story to tell yourself. That's a weird, that's an inefficient thinking to say, well, I'm going to keep doing this thing that's not working, and I'm going to blame everyone else for it.
Hmm.
And so that default thinking can be really dangerous there.
Yeah. And a lot of that happens unconsciously, doesn't it?
Oh, most of it does.
Hmm. So it's quite a challenge then to break that pattern, isn't it? So what are some of the things that you do to help people break that pattern?
You know, the number one thing is, and in the book, in Company Culture for Dummies, there's this whole exercise around exploring your beliefs and then saying, you know, is that true? Do you know that to be true? Is there any way there's anything else true? And so if I believe that workers today are disengaged and they're lazy and they don't care, what are the actions that makes me take? Will I act this way then? Okay. What is another belief you could have? What is a new belief you could have? Well, I could believe that they just don't understand what we're doing and they need more information. Okay. And if you had that belief, what actions would you take? Well, I would probably spend more time teaching them about our business and telling them what we do and helping them understand how they fit into it. Okay. Have you tried that? And if you haven't tried it, well, why don't we see what happens? And so what I often find is that people just aren't aware of that thinking. And so stopping and saying, let's kind of just do a beliefs inventory. What do you believe about workers? What do you believe about job applicants? What do you believe about work ethic today? What do you believe about, you know, the way people manage? And you start to understand that it's usually not based on true information. It's based on some other version. And so sometimes just having those conversations with people and having them think about what they believe, because we don't think about what we believe either. You know, You don't regularly sit down and say, what are my beliefs on this topic? You know, we don't do that. And it's an interesting exercise when you get people just to even sit down and work on it. When I do management workshops or leadership workshops, this is a core part of it. It's this part where they, you know, I give them some prompts of what do you believe about this and this and this at work, and they go through and they do some journaling, and then we tell stories around it. And what's interesting is sometimes it's conflicting. Sometimes people at the same table will say, well, I believe this about work. Someone else will say, I believe this about work. And I say, well, those are two different things, so let's talk about what might the reality be and how would that shift the way you act. And you know, the interesting disconnect is that people don't realize that they act differently because of what they believe. It's such a simple thing, but it so often happens that when I say to them, okay, so you just told me that you believe that employees are only out for themselves and they only care about, you know, getting ahead. Because you believe that, what actions do you take? And that is always an aha moment for people because they never realize that the little stories they tell themselves, that little story in their head about how people today are, that was impacting the way they treated them. And then I said, well, if you're treating them that way, how might they misunderstand that? What could their belief be? Well, if I didn't trust people, I might be withholding of information. I might be double checking their work. I might be micromanaging them. Okay. And if those are your actions, what beliefs might that make them have? Well, they might believe that I think they're a bad person, and they might believe that I don't trust them, and they might believe that I think they can't do things right. Okay, and if they believed that, what would they do? And you realize it's kind of like a vicious circle.
That's right.
And a lot of times people just never have stopped to think about it. They're so busy. Everyone's so busy.
And it, in kind of at the fundamental level, the beliefs underpin the culture, don't they?
Oh, and it ends up being such a part of it. You know, if you go back to what we were saying before about the stories and how culture is basically, you know, the operating system, and the operating system is basically a series of stories weave together to create one big narrative. Well, these beliefs are the bedrock of that. These are the foundation of those stories we go and live.
Hmm. Fascinating stuff. I could go on and talk about this for ages, Mike, but I'm respectful of your time, and I think it's probably a good point in the interview to move on to our buzz, which is our innovation round that's designed to help our audience, and they're primarily innovators and leaders in their field, with some tips from your experience. So I've got 5 questions. Hopefully you'll have some really insightful answers that will inspire people to go away and do something awesome.
Let's do it.
Yeah. So what's the number one thing anyone needs to do to be more innovative?
This is one that I'm borrowing from the world of improvisational theater. And I think it's this idea of saying yes and. So one of the cornerstones of improv is saying yes and, which is the idea that you're going to accept whatever idea is on the table, which is the yes, like, yes, that works. And then the and part is contributing to it and making it better. So often in meetings, or even meetings in our own head, where we're just talking to ourselves about an idea, we say yes, but, like, yeah, that's a good idea, but it could never work because of this, this, and that. Yeah. And that stops creativity. It stops creation because we've halted it. Instead of saying, well, what would it look like? We keep saying, well, it won't work because of these reasons. And so I think the number one thing people can do for innovation during meetings, during brainstorming, during product ideas, during service ideas with your customers, and even in your own head, if you're just sketching out ideas, is to stop saying yes, but to your ideas, and start saying yes, and. How can you take them and just make them a little bit better? What can you keep adding to it? And then you'll end up somewhere at the end that's, you know, totally different than where you started, but that only happens because you kept saying a series of yes, and.
That's great advice, and there's nothing that kills an idea more quickly than the word but.
Nothing. And it's so funny when I watch teams work, managers say, my employees aren't bringing any good ideas. You know, I have these meetings and no one even comes up and says anything. And I said, well, let me watch what happens. And then they'll have a meeting and the first employee puts an idea on the table, and guess what the manager says?
Yeah, yes, but.
Yeah, and it's like, well, of course they're not bringing ideas. Every time they do, they get shot down.
Yeah, and the yes part of it is kind of like a pat on the head, you know, a patriarchal pat on the head, and then but, you know, it's not going to work because.
Yeah, it's like passive aggressive, right?
Yeah. All right, what's the best thing you've done to develop new ideas or new products?
For me, it's really been about reading about things outside of my own circle. So it's very easy for us it's very easy for me to read other books on culture and other books on even using improvisation in a business sense. There's some books on that. And what I've learned is that I just keep patting myself on the back for like, yeah, I'm doing good work because these other people wrote a book like mine. And what I've learned is that innovation for me, new ideas for me, come from looking at other worlds. And so reading books about things that have nothing to do with my area. I read a book recently about Cirque du Soleil, that big kind of like entertainment circus show. And that was interesting about how they create things. And I thought, oh, that's interesting. I wonder where I can bring that. I've learned a lot from reading books about not even innovators, but people doing things in other fields that have nothing to do with culture. And I've learned, oh, that's interesting the way they work together on that project, how that team assembled itself. And so for me, reading has been a really great source of innovation because I often can connect other people's worlds to my world. And it's actually kind of a yes and thing, right? I'm listening to their content and I'm saying, and what we could do with it is this also. And so for me, reading is a really big way I innovate.
Yeah, that's great advice. And I find that from time to time when I observe something or watch something or read something different and think, how can I bring that in? Because again, like you, I read a lot of books in my area, you know, around marketing and communication. And a lot of the time I kind of catch myself and say, well, you know, I'm not getting a lot of value out of it because I think to myself, well, yeah, I'm doing that. That's really good. And that supports what I'm doing over here. So, you know, there's another reason why what I'm doing is a good thing, but it's not really challenging me to improve.
Right, right. Mm. It feels good. It's like, ooh, I'm smart.
That's right. All right. So do you have a favorite tool or system for improving your productivity and allowing you to be more innovative?
You know what I've really gotten into lately is I have a new I have a weird two-part answer. The first is an actual technology tool, and the other is kind of a thing. So the first one is I just got an iPad, and with the iPad pencil.
Oh, okay, yeah.
And what I've noticed is that when I'm doing coaching calls or when I'm doing conversations, I'm using it to draw, and then I can like share that. And so it's allowing me during conversations to take a different type of note. And so it's been actually really interesting for me to use this tool in a new way, to take my these in-person sessions or these video calls I'm having and be able to use this tool in a way that kind of presents information to them and allows me to kind of doodle and say, well, what if we did this? And I can move things around and erase them and slide them to a new page. And so in a very direct way, the iPad has been. The second part of that answer is kind of like the book thing, and it's friends who are outside of my circle too. It's very easy for me to spend a lot of time with like HR people talking about culture stuff. But what I realize is when I talk to friends who are doing other things, friends who are in marketing, friends who are in the education field, working in university, I start to get new ideas from them. They'll tell me about something going on in the office and I say, oh, that's interesting. That kind of sounds like this. And it gives me a chance to think of new ways that I would apply my knowledge to solving different kinds of problems. And that has actually created whole new industries and products that I've worked on is by hearing my friends talk about their job. And it's such a great thing, right? Because they don't even know I'm doing research. I just seem like a great friend. It's like, wow, yeah. So interested in me. And yeah. I just say, what's going on at work? What's happening? Tell me about work. And I'll get to hear them say, oh gosh, I'm working on this project and there's this thing that keeps happening. And in my mind, I'm thinking, oh, this is really interesting. I wonder if they could try this or I wonder if they could try that. And so my friends have been a really interesting source of innovative ideas too.
Yeah, that's a great approach. And it's a win-win, yeah, because like you say, they think you're a wonderful person because you're taking so much interest in them.
Yeah. Right.
I like the iPad idea as well. I've recently got I've got a lower tech solution to that. I've recently bought some notebooks that are actually whiteboard paper. And so I do the drawing and scribble on that, and I can erase stuff and rearrange things and so on. And
then cool. I've never heard of that.
Yeah, and then I take a photo with my phone at the end when I'm ready to get rid of it all. I take a photo just to keep a record of it and can share that.
Well, that's great. That's really cool.
Yeah. All right. What's the best way to keep a project or a client on track?
I think the number one reason that I guess I'll work backwards. The number one reason that things don't stay on track is that most people aren't clear on where they're going in the first place. That so often we start projects without a clear destination. We get really clear on the strategy. We're going to have weekly meetings and we're going to do this and we're going to do that. We're going to do the other. But if you ask people like, what does this look like if it's going well? Like, what have we achieved that this is all working? I find often that I get very different answers. And so what happens then is that everyone starts rowing in slightly different directions. It's as if we all got into a car at point A and we didn't know that we were going to point B, and somebody said, okay, everyone, go forth. And we got to a stoplight, and it's like, well, I decided to go left because at the moment that seemed like a good choice. You decided to go right because that seemed like a good choice. And Mean James decided to keep going straight ahead. Well, of course we didn't end up in the same direction, and of course we ended up sidetracked. And it's because we didn't all understand where we were going. So in the moment, we could use whatever information was happening to make a new decision. So I always think it's really good to get a very clear story about this project is going to be, you know, a 6-month project. And this is what I think it looks
like. No, lost the audio there.
In nuances of it.
Oh, we lost audio for a moment there. So hopefully most of that was clear. So you talked about a clear story to basically being clear on the end result, but then also having a clear story as to how we're going to go about getting there.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's all about having a very clear idea of what does this look like when it's all going well, so that everybody can see that in their mind. They can envision it. And then it's easier to work towards that. We all know it. It's like the idea of, it's very hard for us to achieve something if we don't know what it looks like. But once we know what it looks like, it's much easier for us to achieve it.
Hmm. All right. And what's the number one thing anyone can do to differentiate themselves?
This is going to sound really boring. This is not a sexy answer. The number one thing I think is such an issue with teams, and it goes back to my yes and idea. It goes back to what you said earlier about giving the kids lollipops to keep them happy. It goes back to giving people nap rooms and massages and happy hours. But the number one thing you can do to differentiate yourself as a leader, as a team, as a service provider, as a business coach, is listen better. Be a really good listener, because just so many people aren't. And when you do listen to people and you really listen to understand their story, that's how you can differentiate yourself. You make yourself stand out quite a bit when that happens.
Mm, that's great advice. And you know, you said that may not be sexy or unique or anything, but it's probably those things that people feel, nah, that's not that kind of exciting. Perhaps are the ones that if they got more attention, if people spent more time doing, then they would differentiate themselves.
Yeah. And we have enough sexy stuff. We have all the yeah. We have the iPads and the iPhones and the fancy offices and the lollipops. We got all the sexy stuff. So we could use a little unsexiness and just be better listeners. And then I think we'd really, you know, it's funny when I go into a business and I hear somebody talk about a manager and I say, tell me about a great manager here. Almost always, it's that the person is a really great listener is what makes them stand out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's, you know, it comes back to, you know, you mentioned earlier about taking an interest in what your friends do, which was kind of research for you, but that's listening as well, and it just builds relationships, doesn't it? Strengthens
yeah.
relationships.
It does. It does. And it creates a better operating system for our friendship, and it creates a better operating system for your brand.
Hmm. All right. Well, thanks, Mike. This has been really great. Where can people reach out and say thank you for all that you've shared today?
Yeah. So I've got a little package for you. So if people go to MikeGanino.com, so MikeGanino.com/InnovaBuzz. So I put it just the podcast name, super easy, and we'll link it out to them, I'm sure. I've got a little 3-part video course, and it's short little videos, but it talks about the way to create and fuel better stories in your business. And so there's just 3 little quick videos that give you a little something to think on, and I'll send those over to you, and then you can stay connected with me and hear more about it if you like from there.
Fantastic. That I really appreciate that. And I'm sure our audience will appreciate that as well. And we will have links to that in the show notes.
Awesome.
So what's the number one piece of advice you'd give to any business owner who wants to be a leader in innovation, in productivity, and having an engaged workforce to create wonderful experiences for customers, for their employees, and improve their bottom line?
The number one piece of advice I would have is besides buying Company Culture for Dummies, because then you have all the
yeah.
advice you
need, yeah.
no matter what you want to do. But the other piece of big advice I would say is to what we said earlier, to really think about, is what you believe, the little stories you're telling yourself, are they true? And are they creating effective actions on your part? And if they're not, then be willing to change those beliefs so that you can get a whole new kind of action from yourself, because those little stories that we tell ourselves are the things that are blocking innovation, they're blocking service, they're blocking engagement. And so go, if they're not working for you, be willing to throw those stories away and create new ones for yourself.
Mm, that's right. Well, my business coach, one of her favorite questions is, how's that working for you? You
know,
once
I love
once
that.
We get to that point. So, yeah, and if you can't answer that with, well, it works really well, then it's exactly like you say, let's try something different. Let's throw it away and try a different behavior and maybe substitute the belief. So great advice. All right. Well, finally, who would you like me to interview on a future InnovaBuzz podcast and why?
You know who I think you would have a lot of fun talking with is my friend Anise Kavanaugh. And Anise Kavanaugh has a program called the IEP method. And she's got a great book called Contagious Culture. And her book really, really goes deep. Her whole method goes deep on how our energy, the way we show up in the world, how it impacts how other people perceive us. So for business coaches, for business leaders, how your energy impacts how other people perceive you. And she's just awesome and she's fun. And I think you'd have a ton of fun talking to her.
Okay. So that's our niece, is it?
Yeah. Anise Kavanaugh.
All right, Anise. So if you're listening to this, we'll be sending you an invitation to the Innova Buzz podcast courtesy of Mike Ganino. All right. So thanks so much for sharing your time and your insights with us today on the Innova Buzz podcast. I've really enjoyed this immensely. I've learned a lot. I think there's been a lot of gold nuggets in what you've talked to us about today, and I hope that the audience gets a lot out of this. And I really appreciate you sharing the three video set with us as well. So thanks again, and I wish you all the best for the future and for the launch of the Company Culture for Dummies book. I look forward to getting a hold of a copy of that, and we'll have a link to the that in the show notes as well, because you can pre-order it on Amazon at the moment. And let's keep in touch.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much. This was a total blast, and I always love talking to an Aussie when I can. So thanks for having me on the show and giving me a chance to share these stories with you.
Thanks. That was another fun and hugely valuable episode. I hope you enjoyed hearing from Mike as much as I enjoyed the interview. All the ideas and tips that Mike shared with us can be found at innovabiz.co/Mike Ganino. That is MikeGanino. All lowercase, all one word, innovabiz.co/Mike Ganino. Just a reminder, it is .co, not .com. Now, you'll find contact information for getting in touch with Mike there, as well as links to the website and the book Company Culture for Dummies. Mike has also generously made available a 3-part video series just for our listeners, helping you to create and fuel better stories in your business. You can get that by visiting mikeganino.com/InnovaBuzz. That's MikeGanino.com/InnovaBuzz. Mike suggested I interview Anise Kavanaugh, founder of the IEP method, which is International Energetic Presence, and author of the book Contagious Culture, on a future Innova Buzz podcast. Sounds fascinating, and I'm really looking forward to that interview. So Anise, keep an eye on your inbox for an invitation from us to the Innova Buzz podcast, courtesy of Mike Ganino. Stay connected. Head on over to iTunes or Stitcher or Pocket Casts and subscribe to the Innova Buzz podcast so you make sure you'll never miss another episode. We'd also love you to leave us a review, because what you think matters. Take some of the ideas you've heard today and apply them in your business. Any thoughts, ideas, suggestions or questions, share them in the comments below the blog post. And remember, if you want to get better marketing results than you ever have, join our fantastic LinkedIn community at the Transformational Marketing Academy. All you have to do is go to innovabiz.co/TMAC. It's free to join. Hope to see you there soon. Until next time, I'm Jürgen Strauss from InnovaBiz. Remember to be awesome and keep innovating.